That's John Strauss. And this is Indiana Weekend, a kind of a radio magazine show about the interesting places and intriguing people in our part of the state. Always interested in your thoughts, drop us a note at indianaweekend@gmail.com if you have a suggestion or a comment. Let us know what's going on where you are. Just a quick note, partly personal. Always good to get out of the studio and see our friends around the listening area. We've spoken recently with folks from Rotary, the Chamber, Muncie Exchange Club, Association of Lifelong Learners. It's fun to talk about some of our favorite Indiana places, stories, and people. Of course, we're there to listen, too, to see what's on your mind. If you'd like a speaker for your group, drop us a note. Give us a call. Glad to come visit. This has been a pretty raucous election season, but the one issue it seems nobody's yelling about may yet hang in the balance in this presidential race. End-of-life issues. Because of a 4-4 split and the vacancy on the Supreme Court, the next appointment to the court could turn its direction on this issue. Physician-assisted suicide is legal in Oregon, Washington, and Vermont. California joins the list in June. It's not something that everyone is comfortable talking about, but 50 people turned out for a discussion on euthanasia at a Muncie library recently. It was led by philosophy professor David Concepcion, chair of the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies at Ball State University. How you talk about this matters. I asked him to define the topic.
The ethics of intentionally ending someone's life. I prefer to put it that way to get it as clear as it can be. Euthanasia sometimes has a euphemistic sound. It's not physician-assisted suicide where someone kills themselves. It's somebody else is going to kill you. And one of the things I love about talking about this topic is that it allows me to tell stories about my grandmother. My approach to teaching ethics is to try to have very personal stories and have people think about their own lives in very concrete detail. And so when I start talking about a contentious issue like this, I like to start with a personal story. And for me, it's my grandmother.
What happened?
Well, she was, let me tell you a story first. My grandmother came into adulthood during the Depression, and she was always a terrible penny pincher. I think it was my mother's 50th birthday, and my father took us all out to a very fancy dinner. And my grandmother said at the time, "Oh, Dave, I can't let you pay for me. I'm your mother-in-law here," and handed him a $10 bill, which was nowhere near going to cover the bill. That will become relevant later. So when my grandmother was in her 60s, she got cancer, and she fought it and beat it. In her 70s, it came back again. She fought it and beat it again. And then when she was 83, came back a third time. And at that point, her husband had died, and she said, "You know, I know what going through the chemo is going to be. I've had a full and wonderful life. I'm going to refuse treatment." And she talked that over with my mother and her doctor, who she had known for some time. She lived in a retirement community, one of those big apartment kind of ones in a city. And she found out all the information she wanted to know about how long she had to live, how painful it would be, at what point. And the doctor predicted that she had about 6 months to live. They could manage the pain and keep her in her independent living apartment for about 5 months of that. They weren't exactly sure. She could get some in-home care assistance, but then at the end she would move to the intensive care unit in the retirement community. And that's how it unfolded. Those months went by that way. We spent as much time with her as we could. And when she moved into the intensive care unit, she was given morphine for the pain, which meant that she received a dose about once every 4 hours. And so that meant that about every 3 hours and 45 minutes, she would become conscious and lucid in some considerable amount of pain, but lucid. And then they would, so we'd have little conversations then, and she would then get another dose and either be not lucid or go back to sleep. And that went on for 9 days. The plan with her retirement community was you get 10 days in the ICU a year, and if you're in there for more than 10, you have to pay additional money. And so on the ninth day, when she would come to, she'd ask what day it is. On the 10th day, she came to in the morning and said to the doctor, "This amount of morphine is no longer managing my pain. I need a stronger dose." And he said, "Okay, well, let's talk that over with your daughter. And this is what you've been saying all along. It was a consistent, repeated wish from a woman who was sharp as a tack." And the doctor said, "Well, we'll give you one more a dose at this level, and when you're lucid again, we'll talk about this again, and I can give you some more medication for your pain." And she did repeat that wish, and the doctor gave her medication to make sure that she experienced no pain, and it killed her. And the wording there is very important. It is illegal for a medical professional, or really anybody, to intend to kill you. It is legal for doctors to prescribe an amount of medication that they will foresee will kill you if they are intending to relieve your pain and not intending to kill you. And that's why my grandmother said, "This is not sufficient morphine to manage my pain. I need a higher dose of morphine to manage my pain." And the doctor says, "I understand." Now, in
the timing of this is significant. She was reaching the end of the period for which this care was paid for.
Well, that's exactly that I was going to get around. One of the things that is so beautiful about this is that penny-pinching Lucille Wooster wanted all 10 days that she paid for, but not one day more. She was not going to pay extra for that. So there's this doing, there's this intending foreseeing distinction, which is thought ethically important, and it manifests itself in our current law.
She had given this some thought. I mean, she knew the right words to use. Did the family know that she was thinking along these lines?
My mother and her spoke daily. They lived about 3 miles apart. So this was something that was well considered, well thought out, discussed with the doctor. I don't know, because I wasn't there, exactly how those conversations went down, right? Did the doctor say something, you know, if my grandmother said something like, "Yeah, I'll want you to kill me then," did the doctor then say back something, you know, sort of opaque, like, "I would be happy to help you manage your pain. If there is a point at which your pain is too severe, you could ask me for additional painkillers." I don't know how that conversation went down, but the doctor, to stay within the bounds of the law, the doctor would have had to have it happen in a very particular way.
David Concepcion is chair of the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies at Ball State. Today's topic, euthanasia, and you heard him tell the story of his grandmother. Coming up, some advice on end-of-life decisions.
Indiana Weekend, interesting people and places from across our region. Look for that name on Facebook and drop us a line. Let us know what you think at indianaweekend@gmail.com.
My name is David Concepcion. I am a philosophy professor with expertise in ethics. I'm the chair of the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies at Ball State. Come take a class from us. You'll love it. Recently, I was the leader of a discussion at the Kennedy Library here in Muncie, Indiana. It's a partnership that we have, the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies, with the Muncie Libraries. And our topic that particular evening was euthanasia. About 50 people showed up. Many of them were Ball State students, but there were many community members. And we were discussing when it is okay to intentionally end someone's life.
I'm just guessing, because of the number of baby boom generation people, that this topic would be of growing interest?
Most of us will have to take care of an elder at some point. Some people die quickly. Others of us are not going to quite get there. Our parents maybe died when we were younger. But yeah, it's important for a great many people's lives. And I guess if I had one piece of advice, it would be, hey, everyone, create an advance directive.
Living will?
Living will. There are two kinds, so we try to lump them under advance directive. There are instructional wills and proxy wills. So instructional ones, you say something like, if I'm in condition X, please do Y. Those are fairly limited because most people can't predict the situations they'll find themselves in when they're no longer able to express a wish. So what most folks do is designate a proxy, a medical decision maker, and you do that in a legal document. I was on the ethics committee at the Ball Memorial Hospital for a number of years, and a great many of the cases that came our way because people had not clarified their wishes with their loved ones. So you could get a situation where one family member claims that the person would have wanted this, another family member claims that they would have wanted that, and then the hospital has a big problem. And most of those cases, thankfully, are resolved by some very caring nurses and hospice folks at Ball Memorial who can facilitate a conversation to help the family work it out. But in the worst case scenarios, these things sometimes go to court and it's just very unpleasant for everyone.
Are there ethical considerations here that we're still figuring out? Are there unsettled areas ethically about end-of-life issues?
I don't think this is one of those ones where there is a definitive answer and it's a matter of bringing everyone to realize that answer. These are very individual decisions. One's religious background, for example, is going to make a big difference in how you approach these things. But I do think there are some broad strokes of the ethical considerations that most people agree on. And then we get into the details and people are going to have to find a way to come to terms with things. Number one, and this is often goes unstated, but I think it's really important to say, the default is don't kill people. It's not that you would think, yeah, it's okay to kill them unless there's some good reason to keep them alive. No, it's wrong to kill them unless there's a really good reason. The number one reason is that the person wishes to die themselves. That a longstanding principle in Western ethics is respecting people's autonomy, respecting people's wishes. Unless you're doing whatever it is that you're going to do could potentially harm other people, we tend to leave you alone, particularly if you are currently competent. You can already start to see where the ethical problems come in. Not all people are currently competent. Some people's competence is questionable. People progressing down a dementia path go from fully competent to questionably competent to not competent to make life and death decisions for themselves. The other variables that typically come into cases like this are, is the person terminally ill and is the person suffering to some degree of significance? And this is why in my grandmother's case, most people think that what happened was okay. They're not gonna say we like that or anything, but it's ethically acceptable to a majority of people. There's a variety of polls that would show that. Because she was 100% competent. She was sharp as a tack. She discussed her plans with her family members and her doctors. She repeated the request. It was an enduring wish for multiple months. She was terminally ill, would have died within some number of weeks, and she was physically suffering greatly, if not highly, highly medicated, and even then in some amount of pain. So that's the kind of case where you say, yeah, that's a competent adult at the end of life, has an autonomous wish that makes sense. She's terminally ill and suffering. When you start pulling those things away one at a time, or they get fuzzier, you know, she was in some pain, but not excruciating pain. She was gonna die relatively soon, within, say, 3 years, but not a few weeks. Is she still terminally ill? She was not sharp as a tack. She was certainly legally competent, but she was slipping and there were lots of things she didn't understand. How competent is she? Is that an autonomous enough wish driven from a coherent worldview? So the cases that are troubling, the ones that are hard to make, involve a pulling away of each of those pieces of the puzzle. So that's why when leading these kinds of discussions, I start with my grandmother to say, you shouldn't kill anybody unless a whole bunch of conditions are met. The default is don't do it. Here's a case, happens to be my own, where pretty much all of the things that bother people are met. It also may be interesting to know that my grandmother was an ordained minister and had led a church for many, many years. So in her particular interpretation of Christianity, this was not unacceptable. So they were all met. Now, all these hard cases where somebody's in a terrible accident, it's a younger person. They have never expressed their wishes to anyone because they don't imagine themselves dying anytime soon. They end up in a hospital. Maybe they don't have family to explain to the medical staff what they want. Well, there you've got an incompetent person who has not expressed a wish, who is not in physical pain because they're in a coma. And whether they're terminally ill or not, well, that can depend. What do you do in that case?
Philosophy professor David Concepcion, who recently led a discussion on euthanasia as part of a program in Muncie. There are strong cultural and religious feelings about the topic. Shakespeare's Hamlet pondered, to be or not to be.
This is Indiana Weekend with John Strauss on Indiana Public Radio.
I know you haven't studied this, but some states have changed their laws. Do you get the sense that this is an emerging conversation, that more people are thinking about this?
I can make a broad swath comment about American attitudes towards this. A majority of people believe that a terminally ill older person who wishes to die and is suffering should be allowed to. But what's really confusing about these polls is how the wording matters. Is a doctor going to kill me? Well, a lot of people don't want to live in a world where doctors might go around killing you.
The death panels, that...
That sort of thing. Could a doctor prescribe me a medication that I could take at home where I would end up dead? Well, a fair amount of people are in favor of that. So when you ask, are people in favor of euthanasia, in favor of physician-assisted suicide, I think the cumulative way to describe those polls is, yes, a majority of people are. But sometimes the majority is slim. Sometimes it's up to 70% or so. The Oregon Death with Dignity Act is interesting because it's about physician-assisted suicide. It's not about euthanasia. And that makes a huge difference. Assisted suicide, what do those words mean? Someone's going to help you kill yourself. Euthanasia is someone else is going to kill you. In my grandmother's case, the doctor killed my grandmother. In the Oregon Death with Dignity Act, it's that a doctor will prescribe a lethal medication for you. You go to a pharmacy, you pick it up, you take it with you, you use it, you don't use it.
For people just joining us, I want to be clear that your grandmother knew. She asked the doctor for more pain meds, which she knew would.
This is the thing. Euthanasia, the technical definition of euthanasia is mercy killing. It's thought of
happy death, I think, is what it means.
Happy death, peaceful death, and so on. But really, in our contemporary language, the difference between euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide is who acts or omits so that a person ends up dead. In physician-assisted suicide, it is, first of all, assisted suicide, which is to say it's suicide. The to-be-dead person does the thing that leads to the person being dead. They're assisted in the sense that someone gives them medication or gives them information so that they can do that relatively painlessly, typically entirely painlessly. And then it could be assisted suicide from a physician or it could be a suicide assisted by someone else. Euthanasia, in this contemporary technical definition, means that somebody other than the to-be-dead person acted or omitted in such a way that the person would end up dead. When it's acting, we typically would say killing. When it's withholding treatment or withdrawing treatment, we might say that they omitted something such that the person ended up dead. But yeah, that's how I would speak of it.
And it's a bit murky ethically, assisted suicide. I mean, even though the person is taking the action themselves, there's an ethical component on behalf of those who would be around or involved in that, right? They're not off the hook just because that person is pushing the final button.
I'm a little puzzled by the phrase off the hook because it prompts me to think, for what? They're not off the hook for standing by while someone does something that makes them end up dead. You're not a bystander. You're not off the hook. You might be off the hook for killing a person because you didn't kill them, but you're still participating in an act that has tremendous ethical resonance.
And if you're Dr. Kevorkian, I mean, you set the scene. You put together the apparatus that allowed them to do that.
I actually find Dr. Kevorkian, I find it irritating to talk about him. Not that you're irritating me by asking, because he was an advocate for the right to die. And I think in this country, we need advocates for the right to die, largely because the way it currently happens, the way it happens with my grandmother in most places other than Oregon, it happens behind closed doors. It was my grandmother, her doctor, and my mother making this decision. There were no checks. We didn't have a second opinion doctor come in to verify her competence. No one else saw in writing that she had made this request and made it over time. There was no second doctor to confirm the pain analysis and so on. So our current practice is to have this happen behind closed doors, and that is dangerous to me. The principal reason to me for making physician-assisted suicide legal is a sunshine argument. We need to have checks and double checks. This is a decision of the most serious kind. And so I like that Kevorkian was an advocate for the right to die. There's a political outcome that maybe I desire as much as he did. But he got wound up in his own publicity and zealotry so that he moved from physician-assisted suicide to assisting in the act of suicide, such that it no longer was clear that it was suicide.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man?
David Concepcion, a philosophy professor with an expertise in ethics, chair of the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies at Ball State, talking about end-of-life issues. His advice, delivered here, be sure you make your own wishes known with a living will and any other legal directives. It can be a difficult conversation with family members, but one that could someday provide a great deal of comfort at a very important time. And that's our show for today. A little different kind of topic for us. Next week, back out on the road, heading for another show about the interesting people and places across Indiana. In the meantime, thanks and have a great week. Until we meet again on the next Indiana Weekend on Indiana Public Radio.
Indiana Weekend with host John Strauss. Our show is engineered at Indiana Public Radio, produced by Sean Ashcraft, and special music consultation thanks this week to Stephen Turpin. Major support for Indiana Weekend comes from IPR's listeners. We hope you'll join your friends who are IPR members. You can go to indianapublicradio.org or give us a call at 1-800-646-1812. Join us again next week for Indiana Weekend with John Strauss here on Indiana Public Radio.